thank you all for coming to this joyous celebration of the life and the works of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the founder, the main founder of the modern theosophical movement, who, of course, with others, have made our association possible in the furtherance of building a nucleus of universal brotherhood without distinction of race, color, creed, sex, national origin. All are welcome here to this lodge in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on this May 8th, 2011, or 2011, if you prefer to say it that way. Now, HPB was quite the enigma. She still is today, considered a sphinx by many. But those who knew her personally, who could see beyond the veil of the personality that was sometimes tempestuous, a real teacher, initiate, brother of the great lodge of masters that stretches back to the dawn of time. She was a member. She had the most, we don't want to use the word efficient, but in a way it is. She had the best available body, mind, and soul for an incarnate being to bring these teachings public after centuries of effort, which began in the late 1300s. So we don't want, today what we do is we honor the life and the memory, we renew our friendship, our association. It's a good time to also renew our work and our spirit of work for humanity. And we have three readings, after I'm done this short introduction, from two of her favorite works and an additional reading. We have a reading from the Bhagavad Gita and the Light of Asia, which were her two favorite works. And then the Voice of the Silence, which she translated from the Book of Golden Precepts. So, let us begin in the beginning. On July 30, between midnight of July 30th and July 31st of the old calendar, it is now August 12th of the adjusted calendar, in the year 1831, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and Petrovna means son of Peter. Her father was Peter von Hahn, and he came from an old Mecklenburg line, a German line, who had, how shall we say, received distinction and honor within Russian society and intermingled and married with royalty. And on her mother's side, her mother was a famous authoress. Well, in those days, they would have said authoress. Today, we just say author. But interestingly, she was considered one of the three main founders of the modern, or really, the feminist movement of any recollection. It probably had been 1800 years since women had some sort of equality with men, we think, but that's a digression, so we won't go there. But we come here to celebrate the life and legacy of our lion-hearted colleague, HPB. On this day, 60 or 120 years ago, exactly, The great messenger of our elder brothers surrendered her mortal coil. She came as a world teacher, and her work and her written word will reverberate throughout the centuries. So why do we celebrate the day of her passing rather than the day of her birth? Birth is but a potentiality or a seed, whereas death is the culmination or flower of this life of selfless service. We enjoy the fruits of her Herculean labors, while vested interests still hurl calumny and hatred. We, her students, assemble here today to honor her life and works, and to renew our association with each other, and to vivify the nucleus of universal brotherhood, and to ask ourselves how best we may serve those starving for the truth. Volumes have been written on her life and influence, and doubtless volumes more will be transcribed. So, Helena Petrovna von Hahn, as mentioned earlier, was born in, and you'll forgive my tortured Russian, Ekaterinoslav, on that midnight hour. It was a city that was founded, actually it was not much of a city back then. Today it is. Today it's a bustling city, and it's actually even the head of the neurospace, the space industry in Russia. But then it was a small, sleepy village. It was founded by a Prince Potemkin under orders from Catherine the Great. The city is now called, forgive me again, Dnipropetrovsk, but most of the locals know it simply as Dnieper or Dnieper. It is situated on the banks of the Dnieper River. On this river, which served as a border between East and West for many centuries, and its banks served as an arena of struggle between the Slavs, who were the residents, and the Asian nomads. So over many centuries, and interestingly, that's the Cossacks are actually a combination of all the groups coming together. So the great revealer of Eastern wisdom of the Western nations was born at this East-West crossroads. Her father, Peter von Hahn, and her mother, Helena de Feyadev, as the aforementioned renowned novelist, she died. We should mention too that there was a cholera epidemic at the time, and it was really a pandemic. It was very, very serious, and cholera is a very, well, it's deadly, and it's deadly for over half of the people who get it. So at this time, the servants, who were naturally superstitious, were even more so with all the death and dying, destruction going on all around. And they recognized that someone born on this day would have great occult powers and powers over the house spirit, as they called it, or the house demon. And when little Helena was older, like just a few years old, they initiated her into some of their rites. And so she would partake in ceremonies around this. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. The first important episode in her life was she was born into this atmosphere of dread and disease. And at the time, she was very sickly. It was thought she might not survive. So they hurriedly got together a baptismal service. Now, it's not something simple like today. Even a hurried service back then wouldn't have been simple in the Greek Orthodox Church. It was full of pomp and circumstance, and the priest was wearing gold, long flowing gold robes, and it was a long service, and one of her nieces, who was only maybe 4 years old, was also holding a candle. This is before electricity now. And so she got tired during the long service and fell asleep, and her candle lit the robes of the priest just as they were all renouncing the devil, the evil one, and spitting three times on the floor. And this really presaged, the priest, by the way, was, as far as we know, he survived, but he was very badly burned. And this really presaged her, you know, her future work and with the church. From the very first day, her relationship with Orthodoxy was a stormy one, a fiery one. We should say literally and figuratively. So HBB was very close to her mother, but her mother died of tuberculosis when she was only 11 years old. The mother was only 28, and HBB was only 11. And she had written several novels at that point, so she was really quite a whirlwind herself. She went to live with the grandmother because the father, Colonel von Hahn, he was often, he was always being transferred from one military installation to another. So she was very close to her grandparents, and her grandmother was a biologist and a writer, and a brilliant woman at that. So she was raised by them. There are some incidences of her occult powers when she was young. She stacked a bunch of chairs and tables up to get to a picture, we believe it was, and she fell, and she should have gotten hurt, at least somewhat, but she more or less floated to the ground, and this was the first time that that she realized that she had divine protection, or as it were, or otherworldly protection. It's really in this world, but it was looked upon as, you know, miraculous. Another incident was when her brother doubted her powers. She said, "Well, try to lift that chess table," and there was a chess table, and he moaned and he groaned and he tried. He was very strong, and he could not. It was creaking, and because she had fastened it to the floor, so she was. This was actually after her first wandering. So again, we are skipping around a little bit. Forgive me if we're not being 100% sequential here. She then, on a dare, got General Nikifor V. Blavatsky to ask for her hand in marriage when she was approximately 17 years old. And this, she soon realized, was a mistake. The marriage was a very brief, just a few weeks. And she, with her father's assistance, began her first 10 years of world travel, traveling to Greece, traveling to Cairo, and actually on a Greek steamer that exploded. There was a coal fire. Coal dust is very explosive. No, actually it was gunpowder. It was gunpowder. Gunpowder exploded, and she was one of 16 survivors out of 400 that were on that ferry. So she went to Cairo. She tried to start a society for the study of occultism, but it really only lasted 2 weeks. And at that point, she met someone who would later become a thorn in her side and the society's side, as it were. But we won't go there. So she was also a marvelous, clever. She was a clever linguist a talented pianist, and a fine artist. She was a fearless rider of half-broken horses. Her and her sister Vera were the darlings of the Cossacks. They were just amazed at how well these girls could ride. They could ride like men, and in the male style, nothing dainty about them. They were tomboys, full of vim and vigor. So one time she fell off the horse and she was caught in the stirrup, but she was protected again. She did not, no harm came to her. Okay, well, she traveled in Canada, the United States, Mexico, going most likely by stagecoach, although it's not really said, but she crossed the Rockies at least twice. We tend to think of HPB as the erudite elder woman, but she was really a very, very hardy soul. She even fought with Garibaldi at the Battle of Mantana and was mortally wounded there. And the master saved her at this point as well. So she spent really 27 years in all wandering the world. There were no airplanes back then. They were lucky if she could get a train. Trains were actually the locomotive was a fairly modern and not very reliable method of transport at that time. It hadn't really come into its own. She was sent to America. She had met her master in London in 1851. She was there with her father. She recognized him from visions that she had in her youth, and they recognized each other. And at first he signaled, don't come near me. And then a little later on, the next day or two, they met and he let her know what was in store. He gave her a sketch of the life and her mission in Hyde Park in London. So she came to America in 1873, and she came to New York City on July 8th, 1873. She did spend a few months in Philadelphia, and at this time she was investigating the seances and spiritualism and all these wondrous things, and was trying to combat all the emotionalism in it and the passivity in it and explain the phenomenon. And her hope was to reform the spiritualist movement and give it a sound basis in philosophy, but that was not to come to pass. In New York, she met Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, who of course was another founder of the Theosophical Society. And they went to the farm in Chittenden, New York, the Eddy homestead in Chittenden, not New York, excuse me, Vermont, in Chittenden, Vermont. And there they investigated that. And then they came in, she came in contact also with William Q. Judge, who Olcott were both lawyers, and they knew each other professionally, and they had an interest. So the Theosophical Society, to make a very long story short, after a few informal meetings, came to pass on November 17th, 1875 in New York City. From the very beginning, HPB knew that as soon as it had a footing in America, that she was to go to India and there to give that the impulse, to give it to meet the you know, India has many religions, but it has it's a storehouse of wisdom, and to work with the various religions and factions in India. So it's really too much to go into now, but she then went to Germany to, you know, to write The Secret Doctrine, and to France and to England, and she spent her last few years in England. We wanted to just mention her books because let's see. We wanted to briefly mention her books, and of course she had publications, correspondence. She was constantly writing from dawn to dusk, many days, and way into the night. But she had help, of course. We know that she had help in writing these books. That it was coming through her, but she was not passive. She had much knowledge and understanding. Isis Unveiled, 1877. That was written in New York, and that was a magnificent attack upon the materialism of religion and science. In July 8th, she became an American citizen of 1878, happened to be the first Russian woman to do so. Isis shows neither mercy for enthroned error nor reverence for usurped authority. It is meant to do justice and speak truth alike without malice or prejudice. It is a master key to the mysteries of ancient and modern science and theology in previous recorded history. Then Secret Doctrine, 1888, that was her magnum opus, a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy. We're just going to mention the books now. Key to Theosophy, 1889, to unlock a door that leads to deeper study. Transactions of the Blavatsky Lodge, which were the leading lights in London at the time, scientific and literary, question and answer, and also The Voice of the Silence in 1889, a devotional treatise translated from the Book of the Golden Precepts. So at this time, we will have the three readings, and then we will have a talk on HPB.
From the Voice of the Silence, Arhans and sages of the boundless vision are rare, as is the blossom of the Udumbara tree. Arhans are born at midnight hour. Together with the sacred plant of 9 and 7 stalks, the holy flower that opes and blooms in darkness, out of the pure dew, and on the frozen bed of snow-capped heights that are trodden by no sinful foot. No Arhan, O Lanu, becomes one in that birth when, for the first, the soul begins to long for final liberation. Yet, O thou anxious one, no warrior volunteering fight in the fierce strife between the living and the dead. Not one recruit can ever be refused the right to enter on the path that leads toward the field of battle. For either he shall win or he shall fail. Yea, if he conquers, nirvana shall be his. Before he cast his shadow off his mortal coil, that pregnant cause of anguish and illimitable pain, in him will men a great and holy Buddha honor. And if he falls, even though he does not fall in vain, The enemies he slew in the last battle will not return to life in the next birth that will be his. For if thou wouldst nirvana reach or cast the prize away, let not the fruit of action and inaction be thy motive, O thou of dauntless heart. Know that the Bodhisattva, who liberation changes for renunciation to don the miseries of secret life, is called thrice honored, O thou candidate for woe throughout the ages. The path is one, disciple, yet in the end twofold. Marked are its stages by 4 and 7 portals. At one end, bliss immediate, and at the other, bliss deferred. Both are of merit the reward. The choice is thine. The one becomes the two, the open and the secret. The first one leadeth to the goal, the second to self-immolation. When to the permanent is sacrificed the mutable, the prize is thine. The drop returneth to whence it came. The open path leads to the changeless change, nirvana, the glorious state of absoluteness, the bliss past human thought. Thus, the first path is liberation. But path the second is renunciation, and therefore called the path of woe. That secret path leads the Arhan to mental woes unspeakable, woe for the living dead and helpless pity for the men of karmic sorrow. The fruit of karma, sages dare not still. For it is written, teach to eschew all causes, the ripple of effect, as the great tidal wave, thou shalt let run its course. The open way, no sooner hast thou reached its goal, will lead thee to reject the bodhisattvic body and make thee enter the thrice glorious state of Dharmakaya, which is oblivion of the world and men forever. The secret way leads also to para-nirvanic bliss, but at the close of kalpas without number. Nirvana's gained and lost from boundless pity and compassion for the world of deluded mortals. But it is said, the last shall be the greatest. Samyak Sambuddha, the teacher of perfection, gave up his self for the salvation of the world by stopping at the threshold of nirvana, the pure state. Thou hast the knowledge now concerning the two ways. Thy time will come for choice, O thou of eager soul, when thou hast reached the end and passed the 7 portals. Thy mind is clear. No more art thou entangled in delusive thoughts, for thou hast learned all. Unveiled stands truth and looks thee sternly in the face. She says, sweet are the fruits of rest and liberation for the sake of self, but sweeter still the fruits of long and bitter duty. I, renunciation for the sake of others, of suffering fellow men. He who becomes Pratyeka Buddha makes his obeisance but to his self. The Bodhisattva who has won the battle, who holds the prize within his palm, yet says in his divine compassion, for others' sake, this great reward I yield, accomplishes the greater renunciation. A savior of the world is he. Behold, the goal of bliss and the long path of woe are at the furthest end. Thou canst choose either, O aspirant to sorrow, through the coming cycles. This is a reading from the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is speaking. What is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge? What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men? Krishna. A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entered into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity, and he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a Muni. True wisdom of spiritual kind is freedom from self-esteem, hypocrisy, and injury to others. It is patience, sincerity, respect for spiritual instructors, purity, firmness, self-restraint, dispassion for objects of sense, freedom from pride, and a meditation upon birth, death, decay, sickness, and error. It is an exemption from self-identifying attachment for children, wife, and household, and a constant, unwavering steadiness of heart upon the arrival of every event, whether favorable or unfavorable. It is a resolute continuance in the study of Adiatma, the superior spirit, and a meditation upon the end of the acquirement of a knowledge of truth. This is called wisdom or spiritual knowledge. Fearlessness, sincerity, assiduity in devotion, generosity, self-restraint, piety, and almsgiving, study, mortification, and rectitude, harmlessness, veracity, and freedom from anger, resignation, equanimity, and not speaking of the faults of others, universal compassion, modesty, and mildness, patience, power, fortitude and purity, discretion, dignity, unrevengefulness, and freedom from conceit. These are the marks of him whose virtues are of a godlike character. The spirituality wise is verily myself, because with heart at peace, he is upon the road that leadeth to the highest path, which is even myself. What is night to those who are unenlightened is as day to his gaze. What seems as day is known to him as night, the night of ignorance. Such is the self-governed sage.
This reading is from Mr. Arnold's Light of Asia. Measure not with words the immeasurable, nor sink the string of thought into the fathomless. Who asks doth err, who answers errs, say not. The books teach darkness was, at first of all, and Brahm, soul meditating in that night. Look not for Brahm and the beginning there, nor him, nor any light shall any gazer see with mortal eyes, or any searcher known by mortal mind. Veil after veil will lift, but there must be veil upon veil behind. Stars sweep and question not. This is enough, that life and death and joy and woe abide, and cause and sequence, and the course of time. And being ceaseless tide, which ever-changing runs, linked like a river by ripples falling ripples, fast or slow. The same, yet not the same, from far-off fountains to where its water flows into the sea. These, streaming to the sun, give the lost wavelets back in cloudy fleece, to trickle down the hills and glide again, having no pause nor peace. This is enough to know the phantoms are the heavens, earth, worlds, and changes changing them. A mighty whirling wheel of strife and stress, which none can stay or stem. So pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silent, for it cannot speak. And vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek not from the helpless gods by gift and hymn, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourself deliverance must be sought, and each man his prison makes. Each hath such lordship as the loftiest ones. Nay, with powers above, around, below, and with all the flesh, and whatsoever lives, act maketh joy and woe. What hath been bringeth what shall be, and is worse, better, and last for first, and first for last. The angels in the heavens of gladness reap fruits of a holy past. The devils in the underworlds wear out deeds that were wicked in an age gone by. Nothing endures. Fair virtues waste with time, foul sins grow purged thereby. Who toiled a slave may come anew a prince for gentle worthiness and merit won. Who ruled a king may wander earth in rags for things done and undone. Higher than Indians, ye may lift your lot and sink it lower than the worm or gnat. The end of many myriads live in this, the ends of myriads that. Only while turns this wheel invisible, no pause, no peace, no staying place can be. Who mounts will fall, who falls may mount. The spokes go round unceasingly. If ye lay bound upon the will of change, the wheel of change, and no way were of breaking from the chain, the heart of boundless being is a curse, the soul of things fell pain. And yet ye are not bound. The soul of things is sweet. The heart of being is celestial rest. Stronger than woe is will, and that which is good doth pass to better, best. I booed who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken by a whole world's woe, laugh, and I am glad, for there is liberty. Ho, ye who suffer, know ye suffer from yourself. None else compels, none other holds ye to live and die, and whirl upon the wheel and hug and kiss its spokes of agony, its tear of tears, its nave of nothingness. Behold, I show you truth, lower than hell, higher than heaven, outside the utmost stars, farther than Brahm doth dwell, before beginning and without an end, as space eternal and as surely sure, is fixed a power divine, which moves to good. Only its laws endure.
Our title for consideration this morning is HPB, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and Theosophy. She once wrote, "Do not follow me or my path. Follow the path I show, the masters that are behind." So while White Lotus Day is in a certain sense her request, her creation, it is not meant as a memorial to her person or as a memorial to her original thoughts. Rather, she designed this day as an observation, as a signpost, if you will, so that we could follow the path that she showed to divine wisdom, to the ever-becoming of spiritual truth, to the masters that are behind. We find Theosophy, that ancient, timeless, divine wisdom, behind, in, through, around the spiritualized facts that she presented in correspondences, analogies, symbols, and glyphs. That's the enduring work and the message of HPB. She acted as an ambassador bridging the gulf between the knowledge of today and the wisdom of the trans-Himalayan masters. We're reminded that in certain ways she did for the world what Lao Tzu did for China. She was a preserver, a synthesizer, a transmitter of ancient spiritual wisdom. She codified the old and the pure records, resuscitating the spiritual heritage, which is the birthright of one and all. She showed a path to the masters, to the wisdom behind all, and it is that path that we are invited to think about and to envision. So while we can imagine why she designed a gathering of souls together, three or more in her name, or why she chose three devotional readings, referred to three books that she would like to have read, or why the message would be focused on Theosophy, not on her obituary. We could begin to mull that over in our private lives and realize that it was later than her death that the term White Lotus Day was created by one of her companions. And in that, too, is a planned message. HPB wrote that the root of the lotus sunk in the mud represents material life. The stalk passing up through the water typifies existence in the astral world, and the flower floating on the water and opening to the sky is spiritual being. She said, "It is the flower sacred to nature and her gods, the emblem of the powers of both spiritual and physical nature. The seeds of the lotus contain perfectly formed leaves, the miniature shapes of what one day, as perfected plants, they will become." We're reminded that that symbolism of the white lotus is eternal and timeless in a certain way. It was over 18 million years ago that the lighting up of Manus began, where the seed of the lotus materialized on this plane of illusion. By communing and rededicating our life to the greater life and the lives that we use to the work of HPB, we participate in the continual lighting up of Manus. We attune ourselves with the task of creating the means with which each human, each self-fulfilled and self-devised introspective thinker can create the means by which they open the heart and understandings to charity, justice, and generosity. And by following the path that she showed, by following the path to the masters behind, we can begin to reflect, we can begin to echo, if it were, the self-sacrificing servers of humanity. Like the lotus, whether we use it as a cosmic symbol or whether we use it as an individual symbol, we can follow the spiritual path of HPB. We are rooted in the mud, perhaps in the maya of physical life, in personal personality and traits. But we know that just as the stem of that lotus swells and grows through the watery currents of the water, we know that as soul we can grow and expand through the maya of false and fanciful starts and stops. We can use signposts that she left in order to follow the path, in order to grow through the maya of illusion and learn to use the physical and the astral. Her various readings were mentioned this morning, but what is a very wonderful study that each of us can do in the coming weeks and months is to look at the dedications of each of the books. In 1877, Isis, HPB wrote that the book was dedicated to the Theosophical Society. And we can imagine that she's talking about that bursting forth from the seed of the lotus, that there's a creation of a heart, of a seed, of a beginning for the needed nucleus of universal brotherhood to come. And aren't we in a certain way an echo of that society as we gather here together in her name? In 1888, in the SD, the dedication was different. It was to all true theosophists, for they called it forth. And here we see another marker of how we might grow as the stem of the lotus and be soulful minds seeking knowledge and understanding. Individually and collectively, powerful magnetic dynamos, reaching for the spiritual world and beyond, and calling forth the path that the masters can use to commune once again with those struggling souls below them. In 89, in the key, she dedicated the work to all pupils who learn and teach. And in The Voice, the same year, the dedication was that the book was for the daily use of the lanus, or chelas, those willing to help in the fruition of the heart knowledge. So think of it. In those final books, we have yet another sign on the path of the true dedication of that spirit within and what can be bloomed and brought about by the efforts of each serious student, if only they seek, like the lotus, the little miniature within the seed or the heart of what can be in the future. So, in each of the dedications, we see signposts along the path she showed, in which there's a gradual bloom from awareness and discovery through a sincere call and yearning for the truth to a gradual realization of what it is to be devoted to the duty and the dedication to the well-being of all. That potential in the seed gradually leads to the full bloom in the spiritual sunshine of heart and mind woven together. Eloise Hart once wrote that like the lotus, HPB's teachings and example not only illuminates the world of thought, but fill men's hearts with courage and clear vision. Her writings give us the means to transmute our lives, and doing this, to inspire and uplift other people. We can see what her efforts were at the end of the 19th century, and here we are in the early quarter of the 21st century. It's for each of us to confront the, quote, man in the mirror, that physicality that's like the seed in the mud and the mire, and to consider, where were we a year ago? Where are we to get today on the path of service? And where might we be in yet one more year to come on the next White Lotus Day? How can we create the moment to bring the objects of her original cause to life, to make theosophy a living power in our lives? How can we begin to establish that spiritual path within that will bloom for the good of all in manifestation? That first object, to create a nucleus of universal brotherhood in each and every circumstance, to transmute the daily and the mundane to the lofty and the spiritual. How is it that we can study individually and collectively the world's religions, philosophies, and sciences, both in the straight line literature that we are so grateful to have and in an outlooking on modern publications everywhere? And in the third object, how can we bring all the forces at our avail to begin to study the hidden mysteries of nature, including the psychic and spiritual powers latent in man? HPB warned us clearly that the path is not to psychic development. The true path to the masters behind is of spiritual enlightenment. And we're reminded again of the white lotus symbolism. How do flowers bloom? But very gradually, very naturally, in harmony with universal law, in a celebration, as it were, of matter and force. The bloom of the lotus is a product of fire and water. It is a product, an encapsulated symbol of the duality of all manifestation and yet the oneness of life. As we volunteer in study classes during the coming year, let each of us be mindful that the all-pervading divine essence, an infinite ocean of consciousness from which all things are born and to which they ultimately return, is the birthright of humankind. The human kingdom is one of the phases of experience that each God spark must pass through during its long evolutionary journey through the worlds of matter. Just as the quality of our thoughts and deeds largely determines the nature of our dreams during sleep, so they also determine the states of consciousness experienced by the inner self after death, and might we say in meditation as well. HPB devoted her life to spreading these and other ideas. She believed that they would help eradicate ignorance and superstition, uproot separateness and selfishness, and lay a sound basis for universal brotherhood. Can there be a greater cause with which to live a life fully and well? Can there be any clearer signposts on the path of spiritual development than what she brought forth as a bridge from east to west, so that we could, in our turn, pick up that service and carry it on for the welfare of all? We have a few minutes left for a time of fellowship to celebrate the common efforts of free and fearless investigation of truth, and a most priceless gift to each and to all. A gift that remained in seed form in a certain way at the lighting up of Manus. A gift that has gradually across centuries of time come to us a bit fuller and fuller until we had a marvelous expression of the entire bouquet of ideas by the work of HPB in the late 1800s. And now, may we celebrate together our efforts to take that bouquet as a priceless gift to each and to all, and to maintain it as a living power in our lives so that those who come after us may find their way to the path that she showed to the masters behind. So please enjoy a few moments together, if you will, celebrating the day and rededicating ourselves to the effort.